Following his drop from the hanging basket in the basement and landing hard on the stainless steel countertop, Andy immediately scrambles to his feet and is busy struggling to pick up the oh-so-thin felting needle by the use of his lips. Picking it up off the counter has been close work, requiring him to sight down his nose like he's sighting down the barrel of a gun, so that when he finishes and turns around, in order to refocus his eyes, he has to squint several times and blink in an effort to reset the focal length. The instant he does, the first thing he notices is that something in the shadowy darkness seems to be moving, hyper-slowly, like a bamboo stalk growing off the edge of the countertop. Suddenly, the recognition hits, and Andy jumps just as the snake makes its lunge. It strikes again, again and again, but each time it misses. Run for the bread tin, Andy thinks. Will he make it in time? Watch it! Yes, he does! The serpent's nostrils are sniffing at the hole. The serpent's flicking tongue invades the space a full inch, and Andy has to back up further so as not to be licked by its flicking. Then the tonguing discontinues, and the nostrils withdraw. This is as far as the snake can penetrate. At least for now, Andy figures he's safe. The creature cannot follow. The gap in the seam is too narrow, and the serpent's unprotected eyes too vulnerable to the sharp and jagged edges of the metal seam. So, at least for now, Andy's safe. Cautiously, he creeps up to the side of the seam's opening and listens. No sounds from without. But he doesn't for an instant figure this means his nemesis has left the scene. Andy was frantic now. What was he going to do? His only option seemed to be to wait. But waiting? How long was that going to take?
And what if the serpent does leave? How will I know? Might it not be poised forever just outside the hole, as far as that goes and as far as any certainty is concerned? Ready to strike again the instant I emerge?
Sooner or later, he knew he was going to have to chance it. But for now, he needed a little break for the shock to wear off and his heart rate abate and his rapid breathing to deepen.
Oh. That's better.
Now, as to a plan, he tried to think like his grandfather. He could almost hear him say, "Analyze, Andy. Examine your problem from every angle that you can. Once you've examined a problem thoroughly, a way out will usually present itself."
Yeah, easier said than done. All right, then. Well, stating the problem, it's, how do I get past the snake? So, how?
But it was hard to think. The aromatic presence in the room was so overpowering it was distracting Andy's concentration, the same way the smell hits your nose and takes off the top of your head when you step into a bakery that's baking fresh bread. It was almost as if the bread were trying to make itself noticed. It was almost like the bread was trying to make itself known. And here was a whole wall of it. He broke off a piece and began to nibble while he inhaled deeply, allowing the smell to seep in and act as a restorative. He continued to nibble absent-mindedly. The first thing he thought,
"Gosh, that's ironic. This is pretty much the same challenge that guy Odysseus faced, trapped in a cave from which I can get out only one way. And there's a cyclops outside my hole, too. Trouble is, I've got no sheep to ride out on, nor any gift baskets either. And as far as eyes go, My Cyclops has twice as many. Two, not just one. Odysseus poked the Cyclops' eye out with a wooden stake. Say, I've got Mother's felting needle. But I can't imagine it's going to hold still.
Mr. Snake, will you bend down here and hold still so I can poke out both your eyes to render you helpless?
Well, that's hopeless. Besides, the only way I could ever be able to get close enough to the monster to poke out its eyes would be while I was in the act of being swallowed. Hey, what about that? I could do just that. Sacrifice myself for the sake of Grandfather. But trouble is, that only makes sense if Grandfather were back inside the church, where he could take advantage of it, not out living on the lam.
Nibble, nibble, chew. When he had mentioned living on the lam, it had caused him to think again of the stained glass window upstairs. Not really that far away, but it felt far away. If only it were close by. To help him cope, he wondered if he could ever again reconnect to that powerful feeling of peacefulness he had felt before. Time continued to plod onward. Andy was tiring of thinking, and he now felt as bereft of hope as Pinocchio and Figaro and Geppetto had felt when they were marooned on their boat in the belly of the whale, before Geppetto had thought of building a fire. Any ideas?
What?
Any ideas?
No.
Well, he's continuing to nibble. He's masticating the bread. That means chewing. And he's cogitating. That means thinking. So he's chewing over the problem, trying to come up with a solution that won't gummy up the works.
No, Grandpa, I don't want to solve it. I just want to hear you read it.
All right.
I just want to hear you read it.
Well, Andy Mouse says to himself,
that's enough thinking. My only options are these. Either continue to wait or make a break. I know if I had my druthers, I'd rather wait. But the thought of Grandfather at this very moment, curled up on the moldy straw in the frigid boathouse, where I had promised to remain on guard while Grandfather slept? And what if he wakes up and I'm not there? And what if I never get back at all? Grandfather will be so heartbroken. Not to mention me. I'll be heartbroken completely. And I've just got to think of something to break this stalemate. And do it now before it's too late. But what? What do I do?
Poor anguished Andy. It is almost too painful to watch. Panic and desperation are feeding his frustration. But it's so difficult to think on demand.
Maybe that's my problem. Trying to make it happen when I should just be letting it happen. Let inspiration come.
Meanwhile, while he's been concentrating, he's been continuing to chew. But the distraction of his crowded thoughts is making him forget to swallow, which leads pretty soon to a mouthful of goo. Just when he's about to swallow, suddenly he thinks,
What do you know? My chewing this bread has turned it back into its original state, sort of like dough. Mushy dough, which is almost the consistency of modeling clay.
I know what he's going to do.
What?
He's going to build a dough mouse.
Ha! There you
got it! He's going to make a mouse out of dough.
At last it can be known. At last it can be told. At last we've solved the riddle of the mouse made of dough.
Mouse made of dough.
Oh, very good. Dough! Now we know what Andy's going to do, and we watch him set to work with unbridled enthusiasm. He is going to build a statue, a sculpture. And as every sculptor knows, the first step is to assemble his raw materials. Now, some work in mud, some in stone. Andy would create his raw material by changing bread back into dough. His chewing it would make it so. So he loaded up a big mouthful and began to chew, transforming himself into a fast food assembly line chewing machine. He had no sooner finished a mouthful than he spat it out and began the next, chewing, chewing, and chewing, until the mouthful of chew reached the proper stage of goo, which was medium gooey. The little mouse had to chew just right. Too much made it runny, not enough, and it was dry and crumbly. It was hard to resist at the end of each bite, the urge to go ahead and swallow. It was tough, and he had to concentrate. The mush had to be just the right consistency modeling clay, so he could pack it and pat it and add it to the growing mound he was building up on the floor. On and on, he chewed and chewed. On and on, he chewed and chewed, and as he worked, and as his creation grew, it gradually took shape. And though the shape of it was crude, it was beginning to look more or less like a mouse, although it had no arms or legs, nor ears, nor tail, only a crude torso, attached to what you wouldn't exactly call a head, exactly. More like a lumpy wad of chewing tobacco, plus a lumpy nose, and in the back, he added a couple of haunches in the place where tail fins usually go, one on each side, but not too wide to make it hard to push out the door. Andy Mouse's effigy grew until finally it was the same size as he, a boy and his statue. And when he was done, let me tell you, his mouth was dry. Dry as the breadcrumbs you find in the bottom of your toaster. His tar baby decoy now complete, Andy then took his mother's felting needle and inserted it lengthwise through the dough mouse's insides until its needle and point resided just about where the dough mouse's tongue and throat would be if it were a real mouse instead of a stand-in. Andy stood up and brushed off his paws.
There. It may not have given it arms, but it is now definitely armed.
As a final touch and to complete the effect, he tied the washcloth cowl around the dough mouse's neck. Listening at the crack, he heard nothing from without. But again, what did that tell him? It certainly didn't imply that the creature was no longer out there, which made it sort of the same problem lifeguards face every day. When to let the swimmers back in the water after a shark's been to play. Has it gone away, or has it come to stay? This doughy macaroon was about to deliver the answer to that all-important question. At least he hoped.
So, let me see. If I push it out, and this ersatz mouse remains unmolested and unscathed, then I'll assume it's safe and the coast is clear. Retrieve my needle and cape and be on my merry way, loading up, climbing the wall, popping in the shard of glass in the broken casement window, escaping, and then running back to the boathouse, thereby fulfilling my mission exactly as envisioned. At least that's what I'm hoping for. Oh, all right. Here goes.
Using his nose to goad it, Andy Mouse nudged the dough mouse around until its lumpy nose was pointed out the door. Then, getting behind it, began with his hind feet to shove. The Trojan mouse responds by refusing to budge. He shoved harder, and it began to chatter and move, so he gave it another shove or two until it began more easily to slide. Much like a timid actor appearing on stage for the first time, he pushed it further out. He waited. Nothing again. A wait that must have seemed like ages, but was probably only seconds, maybe 10. He waited, still no response. He thought,
no attack. I guess that means the coast is clear. Or is it just that I haven't fooled the monster?
He pushed again.
Nothing. That's good, right? Or is it bad? I can't decide. My creation is almost all the way out now. Next, I suppose I'll have to poke out my nose and my head, too, and the rest of me. But wait. First, let me try one more act of subterfuge.
With his front teeth, he took hold of the washcloth hem, which, by tugging on it, affected the other end, causing the dormouse to lift its chin as though it were sniffing the air. The effect was very realistic.
Watch it! Wham!
The creature struck. The black snake seized the dormouse in its lethal maw, clamping down with all the fury in its jaws. Expecting to feel a crunch of fur and bones, what does it feel instead? A mouthful of soggy mush, encased in a terry cloth washcloth. Wait, did I say fury? No, that wasn't fury. Fury was what occurred a hundredth of a second later, when the crushing force of the serpent's jaws squeezed the dormouse, which drove the point of the felting needle up through the dough, up through the cloth, and upwards into the soft upper palate of the snake, the spot that tickles on the roof of your mouth. That's where the needle drove in, driving its point and barb, effectively pinning the dormouse in place, just like a note tacked to a bulletin board. Now we're talking fury. The serpent's outraged scream may have started as a hiss, but it quickly changed into a sibilant reptilian roar. A kind of roar few people, even experts who study them, know snakes are capable of, and made all the stranger by its muffled nature and the fact it was violating one of the cardinal rules of etiquette. Never to scream with your mouth full. Especially one that's stuffed with the equivalent of a Betty Crocker dinner roll. The off-the-charts enraged serpent, by repeatedly whipping its head side to side, sheds the two halves of the dormouse and sends them flying wide. Having no arms to assist in the needle's removal, the serpent tries wrapping itself up in its own coils, trying to lever the needle out. Meanwhile, Andy Mouse, the creator and instigator of this mayhem, wastes not a moment in slipping out from between the ruptured seam and racing across the countertop, which, when he reaches, he leaps, barely avoiding the sweep of the monster's tail, which, had it connected, would have slap-shotted him into space like a puck off the blade of a hockey stick. Instead, Andy drops the length of a dish towel and lands on the round seat of the stool, from where he quickly slides down one of its legs to reach the floor. Meanwhile, back up top, the contortions continue. The beast, like an eel on a hook, continues to writhe and flail and flop, tying itself into Windsor knots and wringing itself out in a desperate effort to escape its torment. But nothing works, and the stubborn steel toothpick remains embedded and dangling. The serpent tries a new approach. Flopping its head to the side and gaping its mouth, it begins to plow a furrow up the countertop, using the end of the needle as a plowshare. The hiss of the snake and the screaming screech of the needle across the metal surface produces not only shivers to any ear that hears it, but lays down a lasting scratch that the humans will be sure to notice in the morning. Checking on Andy, we see he has crossed the floor and is now working his way up the cellar steps.
Hop one, hop two, hop three, hop four, hop five, hop six, hop seven.
Now he's lining up for his final hop, when all of a sudden he notices something. The flopping has stopped. The thrashing sounds have ceased completely, and in the brief interval of silence that quickly descends, he hears what he thinks No. What is unquestionably the scariest sound he could ever imagine, particularly in this context. And it's not a big sound, and it's not a loud sound. In fact, to hear it at all, you'd have to be in a room so quiet you could hear a pin drop. For that's exactly what it was. Ping! Just one little ping. But that one little ping spells doom for Andy and tells him everything he needs to know about the direness of the situation and how it has changed and what he must do about it. It means, of course, the needle has fallen out, which means, of course, the serpent's agony has ceased, which means, of course, the creature is now free to pursue an immediate, mutual, and dual purpose: vengeance and a meal.
Grandpa?
What?
When do I get to go home?
Well, you'll be going home Christmas morning.
Which is tomorrow?
No, tomorrow is Christmas Eve. You've got to stay here. Go through all day tomorrow, and then you'll come home the next morning, which is Christmas Day. Tomorrow will be a long day. Time always passes like molasses on Christmas Eve, doesn't it?
Especially when you're in the hospital.
Yeah, especially when you're in the hospital. Yep, but I'll be coming back tomorrow evening to read you the penultimate chapter, and then I'll be coming back in a taxi Christmas morning to read you the conclusion, after which your mother and grandmother will swing by to pick us up, and we'll go home and have our Christmas.
Guess what, Grandpa? I've got a present for you.
It's a surprise. Your present to me is that you're coming home safe and sound.
It's something you're really going to like.
No. Stop. I don't encourage me to guess, and whatever you do, don't give me hints. I don't want to have any idea what my present is going to be until you give it to me. I like surprises. As long as they're not snakes. Good night, Andy.
Good night, Grandpa.